Hello and welcome to the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook podcast. I'm Steve Lubetkin, your host for this new series of podcasts produced in cooperation with Rutgers University School of Business at Camden. This podcast was recorded January 24, 2006 at the Clarion Hotel and Conference Center in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. The Quarterly Business Outlook is a joint presentation of the Rutgers University School of Business at Camden and the Chamber of Commerce of Southern New Jersey. It's sponsored by the law firm of Flaster Greenberg. Four times a year, the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook brings together leaders from important sectors of the South Jersey business community for their insights into the state of the economy. Today's program includes remarks from Dr. Joel Naroff, Chief Economist of Commerce Bank, Richard Murray, President and Chief Executive Officer of Kennedy Health System, Keith Campbell, Chairman of the Board of Mannington Mills Incorporated, Ronald Wilson, President and Chief Operating Officer of the Philadelphia Coca-Cola Bottling Company, and William Hankowski, Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer of Liberty Property Trust. Today's guest moderator will be Roger Dennis, Provost of Rutgers University Camden. And now let's go to the podium where Steve Greenberg of the law firm of Flaster Greenberg is about to open the program.
Good morning. I'm Steve Greenberg of the Cherry Hill-based law firm Flaster Greenberg, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you here this morning to the first Quarterly Business Outlook of 2006. We have probably the largest turnout that we've ever had for one of these events, and I'm at least going to attribute part of it to this fine January morning that we have, better than yesterday, where we probably would have lost half of our audience. Flaster Greenberg and the Southern New Jersey Chamber of Commerce is very proud to sponsor and partner with Rutgers School of Business to sponsor this business event. Flaster Greenberg's outlook for growth is particularly strong as we continue to broaden and deepen the legal services that we offer. And in addition to expanding the number of office locations that we have, at your seats you'll find some materials about our own expansion, as well as some informative business seminars that we invite you to attend. As you know, Comcast has taped and broadcast the Rutgers Business Outlook for many years. And in addition to Comcast, today we're very excited to have Steve Lubetkin of Lubetkin and Company Communications of Cherry Hill creating a podcast of the Business Outlook. Now, for those of you who are as technologically challenged as I am, a podcast will enable people to access the program through the internet, over the internet, simply by going to the Rutgers Camden website. And that information is also at your seat. We're very excited to have this new technological genre as a way of expanding the life of this program. We have a particularly distinguished panel of presenters this morning, and without taking any more time, I'd like to present the Provost of Rutgers University at Camden, Roger Dennis, who will be our moderator. Roger.
Well, thank you, and welcome to the first of our quarterly business outlooks for the year 2006. And I would particularly like to thank our longtime partners at Flaster Greenberg and the South Jersey Chamber of Commerce for helping support this great event. And Steve, I'm very happy to hear about the expansion of your firm. We graduate about 250 law students a year who are always looking for wonderful jobs at Steve's firm. We do have a great panel this morning, but we also want to have a little advertisement. As a new part of this Business Outlook, I think this is the 41st session, we want to sell you some of the expertise of our business faculty. And this morning we have a flyer that spotlights the research of Dr. Maureen Mimi Morin. I think you'll find it very interesting. It's very high quality, very interesting research about how to boost retail sales. I'd encourage you to take a moment to read the flyer. It's just one example of the kinds of fabulous research done by faculty in all of our schools and colleges at Rutgers Camden. I'd also like to thank Comcast for rebroadcasting this event and their ongoing support for this program. We do, as I've said, have an exceptional panel to try to sort through the tea leaves of the economy for the next quarter and the year as a whole, and we will begin with an overview of the economy by Dr. Joel Naroff, the chief economist for Commerce Bank. Joel, sort through for us a new Fed chair, volatile energy prices, rising interest rates. I could go on and on, but it is called the dismal science, after all. Joel.
Yeah. Exactly. The problem is that most people, I think of economics as being the dismal science because their college professor was the worst one they ever had in, you know, in their 4 years. It wasn't because Malthus told us we'd all starve to death. But we're not starving to death. We actually had a really good year in 2005. And what I'd like to do is give a quick overview of where the nation may be going, some comments about the Fed and interest rates, and then look a little bit about the local economy as well. That'll take the first 30 seconds, and then we'll have some time for questions. But, you know, the economy did really well. The national economy did really well in 2005. But there were already cracks in the economy as we ended the year. On Friday, we're going to get fourth quarter GDP. It'll likely be a lot slower than we've seen in a very long time. If my forecast is right, it could be a lot slower than even most of the other economic forecasters think. We could see 2% or less. And that's the reason for that is the reason why I think the U.S. economy is going to be somewhat sluggish as we go through at least the first half of this year and post a year that's okay but not particularly great. The key point is that the consumer, which had really supported a large part of the economic growth over the last 2 years, is essentially becoming tapped out. Consumption was strong, but was pretty weak in the fourth quarter. We've stopped buying most things. It wasn't just motor vehicles. It was services. It was soft goods. It looks like it was a very weak quarter for sales. The holiday shopping season was very, very much mixed. And the reason for that is fairly clear. First of all, the high energy costs are taking an awful lot out of low to low middle income households. We seem to get used to it, but the reality is draining their funds. Inflation as a whole has been relatively high. It ran about 3.5% in 2005. And I know the Fed likes to exclude food and energy, but most of us do eat. We do heat our houses. We do drive our cars. So for us, food and energy actually does matter. And we have to look at it that way when it comes to the issue of consumer spending, because businesses have been making an awful lot of money over the past few years by controlling their labor costs. And as a result of that, wage gains in 2005 were closer to 3%. Well, if you have 3.5% inflation and 3% wage gains, what you have is people making more money to buy less. Their real incomes are falling. And there's no reason to think that there will be any major gains in wages as we go through this year. Yes, the unemployment rate is coming down, so wage increases should pick up to some extent. So we have a situation where people's incomes are growing slowly, and it's barely, if at all, keeping up with inflation, and that by itself will slow down spending. But wages and income wasn't the only place where people were getting their money from to spend. They were doing a lot through refinancing. And the reality is that the refinancing boom is largely over with. It's not that, you know, longer-term interest rates have risen a whole lot. It's just that just about everybody has already refinanced. And the capacity to refinance, you know, going forward has been limited. So if you're not making it through wages and salaries and you're not refinancing a whole lot, either taking some of your equity out or lowering your interest payments. By the way, I don't suggest you lower your interest payments. Banks really like you paying as much as possible to us. It really basically tells you that the consumer is going to be slower going forward than we've seen. And that's the key, because the consumer is two-thirds of the economy. When we look at the other segments of the economy, there's basically not a whole lot to pick up. Investment, which had been going at double digits, essentially made up for the fact that businesses hadn't invested after Y2K for about 3.5 years. When you look at all the chaos that occurred, you know, starting with the dot-com bubbles bursting, recession, 9/11, accounting scandals, wars, and so on, businesses were really conservative. Over the last 2 years or so, they've made up for that, but the pent-up demand has largely been met. About the only place we're getting, you know, additional economic activity is from the government, from down in Washington, which hasn't, you know, seen a project that they weren't willing to spend, even if it's $250 million bridges to nowhere. Yes, the budget deficit will explode again this fiscal year, probably topping $400 billion. But you can't run an economy strictly on the government spending lots of money. So the outlook there is for a somewhat slower national economy. Not a recession, but probably below 3%, more moderate type of growth. What does that mean as far as interest rates, which most of you, you know, are probably most concerned with? Well, the Fed is probably close to done. Mr. Bernanke will be coming in on February 1st. January 31st is Mr. Greenspan's last meeting. The Fed will likely raise interest rates at that meeting, short-term rates of 4.5%. The best guess is that Mr. Bernanke wants to prove that he is indeed an inflation fighter. Indeed, the worst thing that could happen to a new Fed chair is that if we are here a year from now and inflation is higher than it was, you know, this year, you know, they'll look at the Fed chair and say, you know, Ben Bernanke is no Alan Greenspan, and that's not something he wants to hear. So maybe we might get another increase out of Bernanke, but I don't expect a whole lot more. You know, so short-term rates may go up a little bit. Long-term rates are already way too low. You know, Bill may talk about the wild flow of capital around the world. It's also going into treasuries. That's keeping things down. But the reality is, if you're going to have a 4.5, 4.75 overnight rate, does it make sense to have a 4.25 10-year rate? The answer is no, unless you think the economy is going into recession, and it's clearly not doing that. So long-term rates will rise. The question is when, and don't ask me, because I've been wrong for a year on those rates. But they will rise, and they'll likely start rising in the second half of this year. So that's the outlook for interest rates and the national economy. Locally, we've done really well. Job growth was quite solid. It was very, very broad-based. There were very few industries that were having major problems. Job growth exceeded the national rate. Unemployment rates dipped below 4% throughout this region. That's pretty low. It's headed towards 3.5%. You know, we had a very, very good year, and if you look at the potential risks that might be out there, there aren't that many. Even the issue of housing bubbles, or I call them bublets, is not that great, because while prices have risen, they haven't gotten totally out of control in this area. And even if long-term rates rise, we will have some problems, but likely not some major problems as far as the local economy goes. So as long as the national economy continues at a moderate pace, I expect the local economy, you know, to continue at the pace we saw. So my outlook for 2006 for the local economy is the same of 2005. Pretty solid, which is, I think, a fairly upbeat forecast.
Thank you, Joel. A fairly cheerful report from the dismal science. Next, I'd like to introduce Richard Murray, the president and CEO of the Kennedy Health System, who will share his views on the healthcare sector. Obviously, all of us in the business world are concerned about healthcare costs and its effect on the economy, and we're very interested to hear what Dick has to say about this very important sector in the region and in the country as a whole.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here and speak to you about healthcare for a few minutes. I think Joel's report perhaps did not take into consideration what my sector may do to the economy if we keep at it. Let me first say a few words about the company I work for. Kennedy Health System is a nonprofit health system. All acute care hospitals and systems in New Jersey are nonprofit, except for one. There's one hospital in Vineland that turned for-profit a couple years ago. But other than that, we're looking at a solid sector of nonprofit organizations. Now, we had for-profit hospitals here in New Jersey back in the 70s, And then in the early 80s, when the DRG, when the heavy regulation came in with the DRG payment system, the for-profits really fled this state and haven't been back. I think there's probably a play for both. I think that the for-profit healthcare sector traditionally is known for running a tighter ship, a more business-like operation, and providing quite elegant facilities for those who are able to pay. The nonprofit sector sometimes is criticized for not running quite as efficiently as the for-profits, but they do tend to stay with services and programs that are needed by the community, even though they may not be as profitable, and they're certainly more apt to provide services to those who are unable to pay. But overall, I think one day we'll see both, but right now we're still too heavily regulated to invite the for-profits back. Kennedy has three acute care hospitals, one in Stratford, one in Cherry Hill, and one in Washington Township. But we also have 20 other sites around the region wherein we provide ambulatory and outpatient services, which would include a standalone surgical center with six operating rooms, two standalone dialysis centers, radiation therapy centers. We have two sleep centers. The statistics would indicate that about 28% of Americans have trouble sleeping. And I know that there's no one on this panel or in this room that snores, but if you have a spouse, by the way, that has a snoring issue, you may want to visit a sleep center. It's actually like a hotel room, and we monitor you up. Someone's shaking their head because they've been through it. They do quite an effective job, and so we watch you sleep and have ways of curing. I joke about it, but really, a sleep apnea is a little known problem that will affect your cardiac system if not curtailed, and most people really don't realize that they're not getting a good night's sleep. This group seems very perky, and I think we can close our centers. We also have a wound care center with the only hyperbaric chamber here in South Jersey. We have standalone family health centers, gerontology centers, and a large home health and the nursing home program, and all of these types of things. And this is typical of today's healthcare system, wherein a couple decades ago we were concentrated on the acute care, the hospital stay, and today much of healthcare is delivered outside the four walls of the hospital. And so most systems are expanding into these types of programs where we think healthcare is today and will be more for the future. Let me say a few words about healthcare in general. I don't have to tell you that the population is aging and that this sector continues to grow. It's now topped 16% of gross national product. It was just reported yesterday, in fact, that the states now spend more money for health care for the poor than they do for elementary and secondary education. It's like 21.9% of state budgets versus 21.5% of state budgets now going for education. Now, that does not include higher education, colleges. If you throw colleges in there, that's another 10.5%. So now you're talking really 30 versus 20. But still, it was shocking now to think that states are spending more just for health care for the poor than they do for education. Healthcare spending in general is made up. About a third of it is hospitals, about 34%. Another 24% goes to physicians and different types of clinical testing and services, 12% drugs, 8% home care, and another 22% is kind of a catch-all, of which I think, based upon my wife's spending, I think it's mostly like herbal elixirs and things of that nature. I get a shipment of this green tea rolling in about every 2 weeks that my wife swears by, and I think that that's keeping most of the economy going. But at any rate, in general, healthcare spending has slowed a little in 2005 when the final numbers come in, but it's still running at two or three times the CPI, which in my opinion is just unsustainable. Let me shift gears now and talk a little bit about hospitals. Nationwide, last year was a good year for hospitals. They will show about a 5% margin. Now, that 5% is made up of the operating margin and their non-operating income, which would be primarily interest on their investments. And that year, coupled with the fact that there's been a backlog in replacing healthcare facilities is leading to the largest construction boom in over 50 years in the healthcare industry. Now, in New Jersey, we mirror that, but in a much smaller way. In 2005, when the numbers come in, our hospitals in New Jersey will average about a 1% margin and another 1% for other operating income, again, mostly interest on investments. So, and we also are seeing a large uptick in construction, similar to what we're seeing nationally. By the way, this disparity between New Jersey and the nation has been fairly consistent over the last 10 years. And it's because in New Jersey, A, we're more heavily regulated, and we also have an indigent care problem that adds to that. And the third piece of that is a higher penetration of managed care. So those three things kind of add to the fact that traditionally we run pretty far behind national averages in terms of margin. 1% is very close to tissue, and that's the average. So at any one particular year, including 2005, about 40% of our hospitals will be running in the red. In its 2006 outlook for hospitals and health systems, Fitch Ratings predicts that hospitals will suffer a downturn pressure on revenue from managed care plans and will face increasing bad debts, partly due to changing benefit designs such as high deductible plans. Not coincidentally, a recent survey of healthcare CEOs' concerns for the future ranked the following. Number one, financial concerns of downturn revenue pressures from government and insurance payers. Number two, financial concerns of bad debts from the uninsured. Three, personnel shortages. And four, physician relations. And what they mean by physician relations is that hospitals today are wrestling with their medical staffs. They're constantly in competition with their physicians, who themselves are feeling a great strain on their revenue sources with higher expenses of malpractice expense and pressure on their reimbursements from third parties. And so they're looking to add to their revenues, and they're looking to compete with hospitals in some of these outpatient settings, ambulatory settings, and even work that they're now taking into their office that at one time was done in an outpatient setting. So this is a great concern to hospital CEOs and will continue to be an issue. So all of that being said, I would say healthcare is alive and well. Cost and access are really the giant issues. And corporations cannot continue footing the bill for this increasing benefit cost. And someone will have to pick up the tab for the uninsured. Now, there will be a day of reckoning for healthcare, but I do not see it in the next 6 months. And so when I'm asked to give a projection, I come in with a 60. On the basis of it being a very tough business and on the basis of the fact that the state and federal budgets are very, very tight. And when that happens, they look to ratchet down payments to hospitals, and that will force difficult boating ahead. But that probably will take another year or year and a half to really hit hard. So for the next 6 months, my forecast is pretty much a similar program to what we have seen.
Well, thank you.
Let me just leave you with two thoughts from yesterday's healthcare headlines. One is wine drinkers have healthier diets than beer drinkers. And two, a stress at work has been linked to heart disease and diabetes, and the biological processes, while unclear, are linked to the boss. So tonight, drink wine and think good thoughts about your boss.
Well, thoughtful comments and excellent advice. And if you really want to deal with stress in the workforce, I see Professor Gail Porter in the audience, who's, again, a world-class researcher on that topic, and she'd be happy to sort that through for you. Dick, we're very pleased to be your partner through a variety of academic programs at Rutgers: physical therapy, nursing, public health, and public administration. As many of you know, Dick co-hosts at his Stratford campus through the University of Medicine and Dentistry, the best school of osteopathic medicine in the United States. As an academic administrator, I particularly appreciate the clinical specialties of the past two deans there. First, child psychiatry, and second, headaches. So thinking about headaches, we really do need to talk about the manufacturing sector. And we do have a real expert. Keith Campbell, the chair of Mannington Mills. Again, as an academic administrator, I really want to compliment Keith and his family for their generosity to higher education in the state of New Jersey, not to Rutgers, but to the other RU, and they should get great kudos for their generosity. Keith.
Thank you very much. Actually, people where I work don't call me a headache. They call it another pain, but I won't go there. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Wait a minute. We're from the friendly side of the state. We can do much better than that. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
There we go. Very, very good. I'm born and raised in Salem County, and I am proof that there is life below the Commodore Barry Bridge. You know, an oft-quoted book or a beginning of a book is Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times and the worst of times. And indeed, when I look at manufacturing, and in particular manufacturing and floor covering, which is all that I really care about, look down. Please, look down.
Nice, very nice.
It's not ours, but it's nice. It is the best of times and the worst of times. We have had a very strong economy in floor covering, especially on the residential side. When it comes to housing, we have had the highest level of housing this last year in 2005 of single family and multi-housing throughout the United States. It appears that due to the mortgage rates and things that Joel has spoken about earlier, that we can expect to have a downturn nationally in housing starts in 2006. However, it's at unprecedented levels. So there's still strong demand out on the residential housing side. And what's driving that are new family formations, the children of the baby boomers. They're getting out of college in record numbers, and they're going out in the workplace, and they're finding jobs. And either they want to move into an apartment, or at some time they want to have their own single-family house. And that's good news. Good news for the economy, and it's been a very, very strong portion of the economy. Also, what we are seeing, which Dick mentioned earlier, is that non-residential side of the business, the commercial side, is now recovering after about a five-year flattening. And also, Joel brought this up as well. Businesses are starting to reinvest in themselves, whether they be office spaces, whether they be new healthcare facilities, whether they be new shopping malls, strip malls, or whether they be healthcare and the like. We see this coming on after about a five-year trough. So that is really the best of times. We see unprecedented demand, still good demand on the residential side, and increasing demand on the commercial side. So if you're in the flooring business, life is pretty good. However, if you're manufacturing, such as we are at Mannington Mills, there are some very, very disturbing signs that are out there. 2005 was the most challenging year that we have had in the last 15 years. And it primarily has to do with costs. After Rita and Katrina, we've seen a doubling of our energy costs at Mannington. And it's not only here in Salem, but also on our other five plant locations. While we are more energy intensive in Salem, we've still felt the same natural gas prices throughout all of our particular manufacturing costs. Also, those energy prices are manifested themselves in the cost of raw materials. So we deal with synthetics, plastics, PVCs, And those prices have escalated very, very rapidly, to the point that as we've seen these raw material and energy prices increase, our ability to pass on those raw material or those increases as far as cost increases to our customers, we haven't been able to do so. So it's come right out of the bottom line. Very, very disturbing. Also, we have seen increases in our labor costs. Yes, our folks are getting paid more, but the cost of fringe benefits are going up dramatically. Healthcare, Dick. But again, it's a national phenomenon that we are seeing. I think our healthcare costs at Mannington last year went up 17%, and we are anticipating another strong double-digit increase. And I know the business owners throughout this room are experiencing the same thing. But also pension costs, and indeed we've seen this written and talked about throughout the economy. These fringe benefit costs are going through the roof. They're very, very expensive. And when you add on these cost increases, whether they be the cost of labor, fringe benefits, energy, raw materials, with new foreign competition coming in from the Far East, that's the second part of the Dickens rhyme, the best of times and the worst of times. You know, I'm not pleased with this, but 5 years ago, we did not import any product. Today, about 15% of our product line is product that is coming from overseas. Now, a lot of that is niche product that we cannot make ourselves, but what you are seeing in the manufacturing segment, in some cases out of necessity, are manufacturing businesses closing tent and moving offshore. That's not good. Because these are great paying jobs. These are great paying jobs that are the backbone of the New Jersey economy, I know for sure, as well as the national economy. When I looked at one of the previous economic roundtables, one of the folks was up here talking about new job creation in South Jersey from the industrial segment, and these were primarily small manufacturing, light manufacturing, and distribution jobs, and she said that she was proud of the fact that they paid above the minimum wage. Manufacturing jobs in New Jersey are precious. They are precious. And they pay very, very good wages. And there is tremendous pressure right now as a manufacturer. One last thing, and I say I'm nervous. I guess maybe I'm always nervous. What was the head of Intel said? Only the paranoid survive. Last year, I testified up in Trenton during the budgetary time because someone up in North Jersey, it wasn't one of our good elected officials in South Jersey, they would never do this to us, but they had decided that they were going to add an additional tax on floor covering installation, and we were grouped in, get this, tattoo parlors, massage parlors, limousines, and nail salons. Now, I went up and I testified, and I had a suit on very similar to this, but you should have seen the guy that represented the Tattoo Parlor Association that was after me. I mean, and it really brought to force in doing that, that there are tremendous pressures on our state economy. As businesses, we have seen these pressures in the past several years come as major tax increases to businesses throughout the state, whether you're manufacturing or not. But I know that given the budgetary scene that we have coming to Trenton, that we're going to see more pressure on this. And indeed, as we look at costs, the cost of doing business in New Jersey is extremely important. Indeed, what we want is manufacturers like Mannington to continue to invest in manufacturing capital rather than deferring it to other states, or far worse, other countries. I'm a little optimistic. I'm a former salesman, or I'm always a salesman, really. I gave the economic outlook a 70, which I consider to be a sliding C. That means you slide into a C. That's to my friends in academia. And I see the seam as remaining the same. Thank you very much.
Well, Keith's a tough grader. International trade, profit squeeze, state budget. That's a good C. Next, representing the two-thirds of the economy, the retail and consumer sector, is Ron Wilson, president and CEO of Philadelphia Coca-Cola Bottling Company. Ron is a proud and loyal graduate of Rutgers University, and he's a great supporter of our business school here in Camden. And Ron always gives us great wisdom on where that two-thirds of the economy is going.
Thanks, Roger. Good morning. You know, wait. I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. How you doing? I live in Philadelphia, so yo. Philadelphia Coca-Cola is 104 years young. We operate in three states, but we have a production center, a distribution center, and two sales centers in South Jersey. South Jersey is an important market to us at Philadelphia Coca-Cola and any other consumer goods company. Why? Okay, a couple factoids. If South Jersey were ranked as a separate city, it would have a higher per household retail sales than Los Angeles or Chicago. South Jersey has a greater population than Denver, Dallas, or Baltimore. South Jersey has more households than Washington, D.C., New Orleans, or Seattle. Well, definitely a lot more in New Orleans right now. South Jersey has higher median household income than Houston, San Diego, or Honolulu. In South Jersey, and this is pretty important here, there are more $100,000 plus households than Atlanta, Phoenix, or Minneapolis. Pretty important market in this country. We got to get some more respect out here, you know what I mean? Okay, a little bit about Philly Coke. We're the fourth largest Coke bottler in the United States. We do over 30 million cases. We're also the fourth largest African-American-owned business. We do over $550 million in gross sales. Emphasis on gross. The profits are... We have over 1,200 employees. I'd like to quickly cover what I feel the first quarter has in store for us and possibly other consumer goods companies, since we share many of the common opportunities and threats out there. I'll also try to give my thoughts on what is happening in the retail market. Consumers are looking for more choices, and as our population ages, they're looking for healthier choices. Today, you innovate or die. However, innovation is costly. Today, we carry double the items we had a few years ago. I don't think our sales have doubled. Production runs are shorter, and warehousing and distribution becomes more costly. And new product life cycles are significantly shorter than in previous years. The key to success in the innovation game is creating higher margin brands and packages. Over the years, we have done this with the 20-ounce contour bottle, and most recently, high margin energy drinks like Monster, Full Throttle, and a few weeks Tab Energy. Our big innovation push in 06, and this commercial next month, it will be on your shelves, will be Vault, which we target against the active 20 to 30-year-olds who enjoy citrus drinks. That's kind of code for the Mountain Dew drinkers who to date have had no other options. So you'll see us out there in February. So that's a key source of our optimism. We've been told that about 21% of consumers don't pay attention to the healthfulness of beverages. And 46% feel that beverages without healthfulness attributes are okay if consumed in moderation. However, 33% of consumers limit their choices to healthier beverages. And this last group is growing with the aging of the boomers. After the hearty holiday season, consumers in the first quarter will continue to drive the growth in packaged water segment. We were up 40% last year with our Dasani water. And sports drinks, our Powerade last year was up 65%. And our solid portfolio of diet drinks led by Diet Coke will be a key source of growth for us and our customers. All consumer goods companies and retailers have to sell to all three types of consumers. The successful companies will be those who can allocate their marketing resources against the categories that will yield the most profitable growth. They will jettison losers and expand resources for winners. An additional marketing challenge that gets more difficult each year is effectively targeting our consumers. In 1983, the big three networks had a 91 share. In 2004, it went below 50%. Digital video recorders and video on demand pose a huge threat to those companies using TV ads to target their consumers. By 2007, 83 million homes will have DVR or VOD. Digital radio will be in 72 million homes this year. People are not watching the big three on TV as much. 76 million people, 26% of U.S. population, have video game players. 62% of homes have internet. 61% of the population has wireless phones. The key is successful companies will use these changes in consumer behavior to better connect with their target audiences. At Philly Coke, we've increased the use of billboards. Most of our movie theaters are digital, and we can communicate more targeted ads. In your marketing toolkit, the internet is becoming a more important medium. Many of our consumer promotions utilize the internet very effectively. Our retailers are facing the same challenges we are. 91% of consumers buy convenience foods. That's up 22% from 93. With consumers under 35, taste and nutritional content are equally important, about 32%. However, with consumers over 65, 38% make choices based on nutritional content and only 13% on taste. Our supermarket customers know these dynamics all too well, and they are adjusting their offerings accordingly. Supermarkets are under attack everywhere from other formats. Low price. The first Walmart Supercenter in New Jersey just opened in Turnersville. High convenience. Wawa is considered by many to be the top convenience chain in the United States, but don't call them that. They want the gas business, prepared food business, ATM business, produce business, and they have done a great job at brand building. Look at their coffee and their hoagies. Drug stores sell food, food stores sell drugs. There's been a morphing of all channels out there. And competition in South Jersey is deadly, especially with Walmart Supercenters, Wegmans, and Stop and Shop entering the market. A&P and its Superfresh stores in South Jersey has sold off much of its business outside the Northeast and is refocusing its efforts here. Yukaipa, which has taken control of Pathmark and is re-engineering that chain. Acme's parent, Albertsons, has restarted negotiations with SuperValu and looks like that deal might come to fruition, and that could have a major effect on this successful market leader in Delaware Valley. By 2008, traditional grocery store formats will account for less than 50% of the grocery and consumable market. During the first quarter, this shift will continue and perhaps accelerate here in South Jersey. As regards Philly Coke, I'm more optimistic about the first quarter and the balance of 06. Over the last few years, our sales have been, pretty decent. We've had steady growth, but the bottom line has suffered for many of the same reasons my partner up here talked about. Number one, increased benefit costs. It's been a killer out there. Two, largest per case increase in cost of goods ever in 05 for our business. And that's oil caused a lot of that with the plastic industry, aluminum, fuel. Our tractor trailers do 4 miles per gallon. How'd you like to get hit with that bill? I had a customer, their produce, a truckload of produce in California, not the cost, the surcharge at the fourth quarter last year was $800, just the fuel surcharge on that. Reduced productivity due to increased number of packages, which I alluded to before. Solid increases in diets, which have been great, waters great, sports drinks great, but it's been offset dramatically by reduction in our sugar cola business. And finally, in South Jersey, we do a lot of business. We have a plant Memora, but, the people, they're not renting out their houses as much. You don't have the traffic you used to have. So our business down the Jersey Shore just isn't what it used to be out there. There's a lot more people running around, but we're not getting that velocity down there. So those are the negatives that I think we've been dealing with the last couple of years. During the first quarter, we feel sales will be soft, but profits will be back on track due to, one, we were finally able to pass on some, emphasis on some, of our increases in the fourth quarter, and the consumer is responding in a favorable manner. Two, the huge increases in fuel costs have caused us to better manage service levels. Profitable accounts are getting better coverage, and we are working to turn around those accounts that are unprofitable. However, recent increases in fuel costs could further exacerbate our problem. Three, our new products, energy, I talked about Vault, have higher margins and will not cannibalize much of our existing business. That's important with innovation. For the increased competition among our local retailers should help us. Nothing brings in customers like a hot Coke ad out there on the weekend. Five, we talked about it, capital is readily available and rates are still attractive. Investing in technology is still an attractive option for businesses if it will add value. Six, there has been a reduced negative publicity about soft drinks in schools since our industry adopted a new policy which eliminates sugar CSDs in grammar schools and middle schools and expands healthier choices in high schools. We took most of our hits in 2005, and we are very optimistic about the next quarter and the balance of the year. Companies that adapt to the new market realities will succeed. Those that don't will make it easier for the rest of us. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Ron. I think I'm going to add your South Jersey statistics to my stump speech. I didn't know you were such a good cheerleader for South Jersey. I just wanted to tell you, however, one thing. Keith Campbell, sitting next to you from Salem County, thinks we're in central New Jersey. And our next speaker, Bill Hankowski, from the chairman, president, and CEO of the Liberty Property Trust, is trying to meld all of the South Jerseys together into one real estate market. And Bill is going to talk to us about the importance of the real estate market to the economy as a whole. Bill.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. I'll try to be brief so that we have some time for Q&A. But what I want to do is talk about two things briefly. One is, where is real estate nationally? Because that really frames the question of where is the real estate market in southern New Jersey. And I'm going to talk only about a piece of the real estate market. And to frame that, let me just spend a second on Liberty Property Trust. We are a real estate investment trust, a REIT traded on a New York Stock Exchange. We're in the office and industrial and flex sectors. We don't do housing, so I'm not going to talk about the housing bubble. I don't do housing. We are in 12 states, 20 markets, and in the United Kingdom. So I think we have some perspective on what is happening across the country in the business. And we have a total value of about $6.5 billion, and we have about 65 million square feet of real estate. So it's not a bad sample in terms of sort of what's happening out there. What is happening with real estate nationally, commercial real estate? And in order to talk about that, you have to a little bit understand what has happened over the last several years in this sector. And it is somewhat different than past cycles. We all remember faintly, 99-2000, our 401ks were going, 401ks were growing, the dot-com bubble was extraordinary, and the real estate market was on fire. So rents were going up, companies were renting space for employees they didn't have yet. And then 2001 came, and we had a mild recession nationally, but real estate hit a brick wall. And we had something that had never happened before. Instead of awful developers building too much space, customers leased too much space. And suddenly, demand just evaporated. And there's a term in the business called absorption. Pretty simple concept. Are people renting more space than people are leaving? So that's positive absorption. Or are the people renting less than the people are leaving? That's negative absorption. So which way was it going? We had negative absorption nationally in office and industrial space quarter over quarter, and that had actually never happened before. Even in the prior cycles, when real estate went bust, commercial real estate, there were still more people in office space than there was the quarter before. There was no new demand, but it didn't shrink. In this cycle, it actually shrunk. And the result was that we ended up with a whole bunch of excess space in the marketplace. So as the economy got better a couple of years ago and slowly started to pick up and we heard about job growth, all those new employees went into existing office space that was already empty. So you've seen very little construction, very little new activity, very little demand for flooring in the commercial sector because we weren't building at that point. And rents went way down, way down. So real estate, commercial real estate, office, industrial real estate, is still somewhat trying to come out of what happened 5 years ago. And this is one of the longest cycles ever. We should have been back 2 years ago. And it's not that robust yet. Feels better. I gave it an 80 because it feels much better than it did a couple years ago. But it's still coming back. And the result of that is that what was interesting about all this, though, in this cycle, we didn't have a crisis. try to remember the last time we had a real estate cycle and we hit the skids. We had an SNL crisis. We created the RTC. Government took over real estate. I mean, you know, people were handing back keys to banks. That didn't happen this time. So with stunningly bad fundamentals, the real estate sector was stunningly resilient for a variety of reasons. One is it's a more disciplined sector. There are more public companies. I think one of my associates from Brandywine is, I mean, there are REITs now that own big pieces of this sector. They're stable companies, and they can last through cycles. Interest rates helped a great deal, obviously. So the pressure wasn't there. People could refinance, not just your home, but you could refinance your office building and absorb some of these problems. The other factor, obviously, with real estate is it's a very capital-intense business. So what drives real estate, Joel mentioned it, is capital cycles. And capital cycles right now are extraordinary. There is a stunning amount of capital internationally chasing real estate, looking for cash return and looking for it everywhere. So if you put a building up for sale today, an office building, an industrial building that's pretty well leased in a pretty decent market like South Jersey, you will get a tremendous amount of interest and you'll get very high pricing that for people in the business is almost unprecedented. I mean, people are paying more than it costs to build the building to buy an existing building, paying more than replacement cost. For us, it doesn't feel right. It feels like the market is very heated and it is being driven by all of this capital. What's happening in this marketplace? What's happening in southern New Jersey, where we have about 5 million square feet of our 65 million square feet? This market was a little bit different in this cycle because southern New Jersey got hit so bad the last two cycles ago that it didn't overbuild. So when the demand evaporated in 2001, 2002, it wasn't quite as bad in southern New Jersey as it was, say, in the Philadelphia suburbs. So this market had less of a dip. This market has done better through the cycle. So the vacancy rate in southern New Jersey has generally led this region, something that historically it wouldn't have done, which is to say it's performed somewhat better. It's still not robust, but it has been generally better. There wasn't that much development, so there wasn't that much excess supply in the marketplace. And the sector has done extremely well over the last year or so. New Jersey is feeling a lot better in terms of just generally demand. And you're going to see that, I think, this year vis-a-vis increased construction activity. Everyone has talked about cost, and cost is affecting every sector in the economy. It's affecting the cost of construction. So real estate construction costs are up significantly. I would say they're up somewhere between 15 to 20%, depending on what kind of building you're building where. And land costs are up. The one thing that is true is that there is tremendous pressure on trying to find available, entitled, utility-served good land. And housing developers want it, retail developers want it. So if you're building office buildings or industrial space, you're finding you're actually competing for land. So land's adding another 5 to 10% increase in cost. So overall, the whole cost of delivering a new product is up in a situation where rents are not up. So margins are squeezed. And again, what has made people feel pretty good about it? Low interest rates. You can finance cheaply. And to the degree real interest rates move significantly, and I'm hopeful Joel's right, which is they won't move significantly, you could have a jolting effect, I think, in the real estate sector. No one anticipates that at this moment. So rents are starting to move up. Rents are still not where they were in 2000. That's a long time to try to get back to where you want to be. In southern New Jersey right now, at the end of the fourth quarter, on the office side, the vacancy rate was about 12.5%. That's down almost 3% from where it was a year prior. Right now, there's about 50 tenants looking for about 1.5 million square feet of space in the market. So that's a pretty strong amount of demand. The office sector is feeling pretty good. A number of players are now moving forward with new buildings. Opus is doing one out in Marlton. We're going to look at doing another one out in Mount Laurel. Brandywine's working on a building out there. Davis, Treefold. So there's a number of new buildings that are going to be delivered in 2006 into the market. The flex market is also down in terms of vacancy. It's now about 9% vacant. That's about a 340 basis point improvement over the last year, which is, these are strong numbers to happen over four quarters. The industrial sector, which people kind of maybe don't pay as much attention to, But the industrial sector is actually now fairly hot. The vacancy rate's 7.6%. And when I'm talking about industrial, I'm basically talking about warehouses. I'm not talking about the manufacturing facility. And what's happened is that people need new warehouse facility because it's part of their logistic solution to their operation. They want a building that's cross-docked. They want the high bays. It used to be the center of gravity was up the turnpike. People would often talk about 8A. That market was sort of the center of distribution. That market is basically built out. So the pressure has come both south. So you're now seeing new industrial development in Burlington, basically where the New Jersey and Pennsylvania turnpikes intersect up there on 130. You're seeing a lot of activity. And you're seeing it also have it's crossed the Delaware and coming into the Lehigh Valley, Allentown, Bethlehem. It's actually moving as far out as Harrisburg, just looking for large tracks. People are building, you know, ten years ago, no one built a million-square-foot warehouse. Now that's not uncommon for people to have facilities that large, which need 70, 80 acres to build a facility like that. And so, again, it has to go way out to find a track that big at a reasonable price. Currently, and last year was the, in the industrial sector, there was about a 3 million square feet of positive absorption. That's the best number since 99. So this sector is much hotter than the office sector. And again, right now, between Weitzel, KOR, IDI Rockefeller, the DP partners, you've got several million square feet that will be developed in southern New Jersey in terms of new industrial space in 2006. So I gave it an 80 because for 5 years of waiting for it to get better, it feels a lot better. And clearly all the fundamentals are going in the right direction. So I think 06 will be a better year for real estate than 05. Thanks.
Well, Bill, I think confirmed the theme of the day. Demand good, margin squeezed, and all of our panelists gave us some wonderful insights on the economy for the next quarter and the next year, and I think we have time for one question, so make it a good one. The heat is on. Over here.
I'd like to address my question to Mr. Hancock first, but if there are others who'd like to get in, that'd be fine. Oh, sure. Although nobody's ever accused me of being too quiet. You spoke of the key intersection of transportation facilities to demand, but there are vast tracts of underutilized properties in Camden, mm-hmm. parts of Philadelphia. What is the industry's outlook on redeveloping these underutilized tracts?
Well, clearly there's a, I think there's a very strong interest in redevelopment in brownfield sites. The simple fundamental problem is, are they available in an efficient way that the private sector can utilize them? And I've spent much of my career actually in the public side of the ledger. I'm actually 8 years in Camden, working for the city. And the problem is, there's all these vacant tracks, but they're not fully assembled. You know, somebody owns that house, that one's delinquent, that one the bank has from a foreclosure. So you can't easily assemble the property, and therefore it's hard to get it to be redeveloped. The controversy's going on now about Cramer Hill, et cetera. I mean, I'm not picking, you know, who's right or wrong, but it's the whole issue with eminent domain. I mean, there's a big let's push back eminent domain. Now that may be true, we shouldn't lose our homes, but if the public sector doesn't have a way to assemble sites for redevelopment, you're going to see these tracks sit much longer. And I'm a little nervous that there's kind of a frenzy at the moment that is losing sort of the reasonableness of what needs to be done. So I think the issue is availability of sites in large enough tracks that it can make a difference, and then the private sector will step in. The private sector is sitting on all this capital, so it's not going to wait. I often say to public officials when they ask me, I said, the rest of the country isn't waiting for you to get your act together. The capital in real estate will move to wherever it can get invested now. So I think that's the big issue.
Well, that was a great last question. I wish we had another hour to discuss redevelopment in Camden, but we don't. So on behalf of Rutgers Camden and our partners, Flaster Greenberg and the South Jersey Chamber, I want to thank you for coming. Stay tuned for our next quarterly business outlook on April 25th.
And that concludes the Rutgers University Quarterly Business Outlook for the first quarter of 2006. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Outlook panel in the podcast format, and we welcome your comments and suggestions about our podcast programs. You can send us your comments by email to Steve, S-T-E-V-E, at Lubetkin, L-U-B-E-T-K-I-N, .net. For more information on upcoming programs from Rutgers University School of Business at Camden, please visit the Rutgers website at camden-sbc.rutgers.edu. For more information on Lubetkin Communications, Public Relations, and Podcasting Services, please visit our website, www.lubetkin.net. Special thanks for today's program to Samantha Collier, Director of External Affairs at the Rutgers University School of Business at Camden, and Michael Sapanek, the Director of Public Information for Rutgers University in Camden. This is Steve Lubetkin. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.